This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Words and language matter. So true when it comes to climate change.
If we are accurate in the language that we're using to describe what's happening to the Earth, then we have a greater chance of conveying the seriousness or the urgency.
The Oxford English Dictionary updates the language of climate ahead of the big climate summit. Also today, the hottest show on TV is Squid Game, a South Korean drama that's part Hunger Games, part Parasite. The idea inspired by the modern class structure of Seoul.
They literally live on top of each other. It's mainly high-rise buildings that everyone lives in, so there's no way to really avoid seeing people you know who are super rich now versus super poor.
I'm Marco Werman, and Peruvian psychedelic cumbia crossed with Jamaican reggae for the weekend, all coming up on this Friday edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us this Friday. When it comes to U.S. allies in the Middle East, Israel is the closest by far. But over the past decade or so, the Israeli government has also developed a close relationship with Moscow. That was certainly true during the long tenure of former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Today, Israel's newest Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, traveled to Russia for the first time. He met President Vladimir Putin at a resort in Sochi, then spoke about the visit in glowing terms. Bennett said that Israel and Russia have a special relationship. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is reporter Ariel Osiran. Ariel, what has come out of the summit so far?
We've heard so far an official statement from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's office saying that this was a warm and positive meeting, but it also tried to emphasize the personal nature of this meeting. They mentioned that the meeting went on for 5 hours, much longer than the 2 hours that were expected. And it also said that the two leaders strolled the grounds of the Sochi resort and then walked towards the beach. And so even though the two leaders, the official agenda was revolving coordination on activity in Syria, also ways to curb Iran's nuclear activities. But I think most importantly for Prime Minister Bennett, the goal of this meeting is to establish a good relationship with President Putin. We know that his predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, had a long-standing relationship with Putin, very personal. And so I think as far as Bennett's concerned, he wants to prove that Israel's policy towards Russia will stay the same. I think Putin, on his part, this is more of an audition for Bennett, trying to size him up and see if, in fact, there'll be a continuity in relations between Jerusalem and Moscow.
So Bennett and Putin trying to have a moment. Now, the top agenda item for Israel is Iran. Putin has said he wants to preserve the Iran nuclear deal that the Trump administration walked away from. But Israel's government is against that. What was Naftali Bennett's message to Putin on Iran?
Publicly, Bennett is saying that he hopes to convince Putin to join the campaign against Iran's military nuclear activity, but he knows at the end of the day that's not going to happen. In fact, since the Vienna talks have stalled, Moscow has often voiced positions closer to those of Tehran than those of Washington, for instance, regarding these latest negotiations. So I think as far as Bennett's concerned, he's trying to get Russia on board in perhaps containing Iran's activity, but with the Kremlin spokesperson just this week saying that Russia supports Iran's civilian nuclear program, which is a clear Tehran talking point. There's a big gap to bridge here between the two countries.
So Naftali Bennett took over as prime minister in June. Are you seeing what changes are you seeing in Israeli-Russian relations so far?
Well, Russia is saying that the relationship hasn't changed, but the fact of the matter is they have. I mean, just in terms of the coordination over Israeli airstrikes in Syria against Iranian targets, which happen every few weeks. When Netanyahu was prime minister, Russia did play along with maintaining Israel's veil of secrecy. But since Bennett took office back in June, we've seen a sharp shift away from that policy. And Russian military officials actually openly mentioned Israeli strikes, saying that it was Russian air defense systems that helped target some of the Israeli missiles. And that's very significant for Israel. And Bennett's aware of this. But also on a personal level, there is a slightly different attitude towards Bennett. I mean, 5 years ago when Netanyahu last visited Putin, he was greeted in Moscow, in the Kremlin, and he was even taken to the Bolshoi Ballet. But Bennett, he was greeted in Sochi. That's kind of a tier below Moscow in terms of glamour is concerned. And so I think this just illustrates that Putin is still trying to see who he's up against to size Bennett up. But the fact that the meeting was extended and went on for much longer could indicate that the two got off to a good start.
Reporter Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Some 20,000 people are preparing to visit the big UN climate summit in Glasgow in a little over a week. Among them will be a delegation from Turkey. It recently became the last G20 country to ratify the Paris Agreement, the international pact to limit global warming. Duri Buscarin in Istanbul reports on why this took so long and why the Turks ultimately signed on.
There's a small urban forest on the north side of Istanbul, where office workers jog after the evening commute. The tall trees and gravel paths are a rare slice of green in this sprawling city where more than 16 million people live. Istanbul was home to just half that number as recently as 1994. There's been tremendous urbanization in Turkey, which puts pressure on the balance between economic development and nature, says Zeynel Arslan Gundodu, a professor of forestry at Istanbul University Jerapasha.
Madencilik önemli dersek, bu sefer ormanlar talan edilebilir.
Turkey's natural water systems and agricultural areas are straining under the weight of development projects, he says. One can look at Turkey's ratification of the Paris Agreement as a good thing, as a sign that it won't be taken back later, but it's not enough.
Yeterli değil. İmza atmak yeterli değil. Bunu...
It needs to be put in practice, Arslan Gundodu says, and it needs to reflect the reality of our country. Turkey was among the first signers of the Paris Agreement back in 2016, but it held off on ratifying the climate pact, as officials lobbied for Turkey to be classified as a developing economy. That would have lowered expectations for how Turkey would cut emissions and may have shaken loose some development funds. But the classification stood as an industrial nation. This year was a monstrous one for extreme weather in the Mediterranean. In Turkey, floods in the northern Black Sea region killed 81 people. Record-breaking wildfires decimated the southern forests, and a scorching drought killed thousands of flamingos at a lake in the eastern plains. Earlier this month, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan submitted a measure to his parliament to ratify the Paris Agreement. The news agency Reuters, citing unnamed sources, said that Turkey's government was offered more than 3 billion euros in development loans to join the agreement. The measure passed unanimously, but under the condition that Turkey would only implement the deal if it did not, quote, harm its right to economic and social development. In speeches now, Erdogan refers to climate change as something that drives instability and war in Afghanistan, Syria, and other nations. In this video, sent to a UN biodiversity conference, he's saying that the destruction of the environment is one of the reasons the Mediterranean, a cradle of civilizations, has become a graveyard for refugees.
Geleceğimizi etkileyen bu tehdit karşısında elbette öncelikle adım atması gerekenler.
But Erdogan continues, the nations that are historically responsible for carbon emissions should be the first to act. Turkish environmental activists say they are not confident that their government will follow through on its promises. I don't have any hope for Turkey, says Ruhi Koktürk, a former journalist and organizer of a Facebook page for environmental issues. He points to the coal-fired power plants being built along Turkey's northern coast and the mining companies who have been granted licenses to explore at least half of the country's national parkland.
Çevre Bakanlığı'ndan ormanları Orman Bakanlığı'ndan korumaya çalışıyor.
We're trying to protect the environment because no one else is, he says. For the world, I'm Derya Buscarin in Istanbul.
Global warming, climate change, climate crisis. Does it really matter what words we use to describe the warming planet? The editors of the Oxford English Dictionary think so. Just ahead of the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, the mother of all English dictionaries has issued an update dedicated to the language of climate change. Trish Stewart is the Oxford English Dictionary science editor and is in charge of this update. So first question, Trish, global warming or climate change, or does it depend?
Climate change has become the preferred term because it is more wide-ranging. If you're speaking about climate change, then that covers much more the effects of global warming. It covers sort of cooling in some areas, warming in some areas, really the change in global climate patterns that may not be simply warming, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so 1990s that it kind of global warming feels like it has been retired. You did this update intentionally to coincide with the COP26 meeting in Glasgow. Why is that?
I think because if we are accurate in the language that we're using to describe what's happening to the Earth, then we have, I suppose, a greater chance of conveying maybe the seriousness or the urgency about what's happening. And also because we're reflecting the language that people use. When the language that people use to describe climate change or global warming or people's effects on the environment changes, then I think we need to reflect that and we need to demonstrate and document that change in language.
So let's look at a few of the words you've added. Ecocide, that sounds pretty bad. What is it and why did you add it?
Ecocide is the destruction or damage of the environment, especially when it's reckless or intentional. And I suppose it also carries connotations of the fact that we're not just damaging or destroying the environment, but it has an effect on living things within the environment, on humans. I mean, the earliest use we have of ecocide in the late 1960s, that source itself defines ecocide as crimes against humanity by destruction of the environment. So there's also discussion going on about whether ecocide should be a crime that's punishable. This makes it quite a topical word, so we've updated it to reflect this.
Global heating, that's another new term in the OED. How does it differ from global warming, which is a bit antiquated, as we were discussing earlier?
Yeah, I think global heating is perhaps a bit more of an urgent term, and it's perhaps not as mild as global warming. I mean, if it's in the middle of winter, then you might appreciate a bit of warmth. But I think global heating is perhaps a bit more comprehensive and cover the effects of this rise in temperature a bit more than global warming does.
Is there a general criteria for the OED to add a word?
We'd like to see the word in print for 10 years before we add it. That could be newspapers, it could be books, it could be journals, it could be online blogs. And we also like to see it being used in a variety of contexts. So we're seeing a lot of them appearing in newspapers, on Twitter, on blogs. They're appearing in our everyday conversations. So once they've reached that level of penetration into our language, then that's what we like to see before we add them.
So one other new entry, Trish, in the OED, climate refugee. I mean, that can be a tricky term, as we've been finding. What does it mean specifically?
Specifically, its meaning has actually changed quite a lot. When it was first coined, it was referring to a person who moved to a different part of the world because the climate was more congenial. But now we use it to refer to a person who's forced to move to a different area because of the effects of climate change. So the meaning has changed quite a bit.
In the announcement from the Oxford University Press about these climate language updates to the OED, it's mentioned several times that though these phrases are new in our vocabulary, the phenomena many of them describe, you say, are not new. Why did you feel compelled to point that out?
I think because it helps us understand the sort of processes that these are explaining are not new. So if you look at something like climate change, it's really easy, I suppose, to portray that as something we've only just noticed. So maybe it's not that serious, or maybe we haven't got a good enough understanding of it. But people recognized back in the mid-19th century that human behavior may have an impact on the environment. Of course, at that time, they were talking in a much more localized sense. But I think it's important to recognize that these sorts of discussions about our impact on the environment have been going on for quite a while in the past.
Trish Stewart is the science editor at the Oxford English Dictionary, which has just issued an update of the language of climate change just ahead of the big climate summit in Glasgow. Trish, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, scientists use driftwood to study the Arctic's past.
I think it's surprising. It's nice to see.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This week saw some big environmental prizes handed out.
I am delighted to announce that the first ever Earthshot Prize to protect and restore nature is awarded to the Republic of Costa Rica.
The inaugural edition of the Earthshot Prizes, organized by the British royal family, awarding millions of dollars to the winners. What Costa Rica did to be one of the first winners, today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The British royal family recognized Costa Rica because the country has a truly innovative conservation model. Arturo Sanchez Asofefa is from Costa Rica and has been studying their conservation program since it began more than two decades ago. Arturo is now an environmental policy expert at the University of Alberta in Canada. So Costa Rica's model is something called payment for environmental services. Explain what that means, Arturo, and how it actually works.
Well, the concept of payments for environmental services basically is money that is given to farmers to avoid to cut forests.
Are there other environmental benefits that have come with Costa Rica's payment for environmental services scheme?
Yes, I can see three right off the bat. Biodiversity, water production, and carbon fixation. And I think that there is another fourth one that we don't really usually call it tangible, which is the promotion of secondary growth around patches of forest that are with payments. Those patches become seeds, and those seeds are fundamental to promote secondary growth in the country.
It's almost like the program is contagious for other patches of forest.
Correct. And help to build connectivity between patches, biological corridors. So it is an absolutely fantastic program. It's just very unique. And the Costa Ricans should be very proud to have this program be recognized internationally, which is not the first time. But the payment for environmental systems has been actually copied for other countries.
Yeah, so it's been duplicated by other countries. What do you think the rest of the world can learn from this conservation model?
What we can learn is that monetary investment at the micro-targeting level, basically thinking about putting a small amounts of money in different elements of the area where you have high deforestation, pay off in the long term. We have to recognize also that you have different forces controlling deforestation around the world. Some of the progress that we see in Costa Rica in payments for environmental services may not be what Brazil or Malaysia or Indonesia can actually implement in their own countries. But it is a very important stepping stone on financial mechanisms to promote forest conservation.
So why do you think it would be harder to introduce this scheme to a country like Brazil?
Because you need two things. One is the proper legislation, and the second is proper funding framework that doesn't depend on international funders. So in Costa Rica, they developed a mechanism to pay for it. And the mechanism was to put 5% tax in the gasoline. And the money from that tax was distributed to the people that were supposed to implement the payments. So at the end of the day, the payment became totally independent of the international forces for funding it because it can be limited.
Arturo, you're from Costa Rica, as I said. What do you remember of the forests that you grew up around?
Well, majestic, I think. The water and the rivers and the birds. And going as a Boy Scout when I was a young into the jungle, learning is always very clear in my mind.
Well, so it must mean a lot to you personally that Costa Rica got one of the Earthshot prizes this year. And what does it mean to you knowing these forests have these protections going into the future?
Absolutely very proud to know that we have right now 60% forest cover. It shows that a little country like Costa Rica can do well and can show to the world how to do conservation.
Arturo Sanchez Azofefa is an environmental policy expert at the University of Alberta. He's been studying the Costa Rican government's conservation projects for 20-plus years. Costa Rica has now won one of the inaugural Earthshot Prizes. Thank you very much, Arturo. Great to meet you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Marco. Thank you for having me.
Let's stick with the climate for a few minutes and go from near the equator to the extreme north. Arctic sea ice plays a big role in controlling the climate. Knowing how it's changed in the past is a key to understanding the future climate of the Earth. Some emerging research is adding a new tool for scientists to study where and when the Arctic was frozen over in the past. They're looking at driftwood. Here's the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
Growing up in the UK, scientist Georgia Hole used to see driftwood on the beach, and it got her thinking.
It's quite a romantic idea when you see driftwood, knowing that it's come from somewhere really far away and from kind of a land completely different.
In the Arctic Ocean, driftwood mostly either sinks or gets trapped in sea ice. And if that happens, it does not stay in the same place.
When we have the right conditions, surface circulations within the Arctic Ocean can then carry it thousands of miles to reach basically the complete opposite side of the Arctic. And there it will sit.
As a PhD student at Oxford University, Hole wanted to know whether Arctic driftwood could help teach her something about how much sea ice covered the Arctic Ocean hundreds of years ago.
Basically, we wanted to see just how much driftwood can be a reflection of sea ice distribution patterns.
There are other clues scientists look at. Tiny fossilized critters on the bottom of the seafloor can teach them whether an area was once covered in ice. And starting about in the 1800s, documents from Arctic fishing boats, shipping records, and sealers start to appear.
Initially, they're just sort of the ship logs.
Wesley Farnsworth at the University of Iceland was a collaborator on Hole's research.
If you're a captain on a boat or if you're the first mate on a boat, I think it starts out as you're describing the seas that you're sailing through.
To add to this historical record, Farnsworth, Hole, and their team collected samples of driftwood. They gathered it on the Arctic archipelago of Svalbard, between mainland Norway and the North Pole. They looked at tree ring patterns to find out where the driftwood came from, and that told them where and when there was lots of sea ice, going back some 500 years. When they compared their findings to existing ice records,
we found that it matched up very well.
I think it's surprising. It's nice to see.
Their results, published this month, are evidence that driftwood can be used as what's called a proxy, something scientists can use to help decode the history of Arctic sea ice and ocean circulation patterns.
Proxies are witnesses of a world that no longer exists.
Valerie Truet studies a well-known proxy, tree rings.
So, rings. You can see the rings.
When we speak on Zoom, she holds up a thin strip of wood to her camera to show me the rings.
If this is making you dizzy, you should mention. It forms the
she explains that in years with good growing conditions, those rings are thicker. In bad ones, they're thinner. Truet, who's a professor in the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona, says these types of records are key to understanding climate change.
We haven't been recording the climate for very long.
Globally, temperature records from instruments like thermometers only go back about a century.
And that's the same time period that we've also started messing with the climate. So without proxies, we don't actually have a good understanding of what our natural climate looks like.
The driftwood washing up on Svalbard's beaches gives us a better understanding of how humans have messed with the climate. One key finding, there's been almost no fresh driftwood washing ashore in the past 30 years, a sign that the sea ice needed to transport it across the Arctic Ocean is disappearing. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
We'll be right back with more in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. Belarus is handing out lots of tourist visas to Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans, and the EU is not happy about it. We'll explain why. Plus, mushroom hunting season in Catalonia.
Hola! Estoy flipando!
You don't need to know Catalan to understand that, but some folks worry the secret's out. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Are you one of the millions of viewers who nearly broke the internet by streaming Squid Game on Netflix? If so, you'll recognize the scene from episode one. It takes place in a subway station in the South Korean capital, Seoul. A down-and-out compulsive gambler is desperate to get money for his daughter's birthday present. He's already heavily in debt to loan sharks, when suddenly a charming, mysterious man at the station lures him into a children's game. If he wins a round, he gets a cash prize. If he loses, he won't owe the recruiter money, but he will get slapped. Later, the stakes of the game get much bigger and deadlier. Squid Game is intense, it's brutal, and it is fiction, but it does not come out of nowhere. Jean Kim is a psychiatrist who teaches at George Washington University. She wrote about Squid Game this month in The American Scholar. So for those of us who have not seen the series yet, introduce us to Squid Game, Jean, and why you chose to write about it.
Sure. Squid Game is a show where it's set in modern-day Seoul, and the protagonist is in a really dire situation and joins unintentionally this game. It's this unexpectedly horrifying game where the stakes are really high because you could win a $40 million prize at the end of it. But unfortunately, as the contestants find out, it's because there's only one winner at the end. The only one person, spoiler alert, being alive at the end. So it's a pretty high stakes game.
And what actually is Squid Game? It's an old game, right?
It's apparently a children's game, kind of like a version of hopscotch. Most South Koreans apparently know this game very well. So for it to have this dark spin on the show is quite a thing to see.
Right. Because, of course, in the series, it's got a much more insidious win-lose outcome.
Right.
So as a psychiatrist, I'm really intrigued. Why did you choose to write about Squid Game?
Sure. So I guess my background is Korean-American, and seeing that this show became the number one show on Netflix, I was kind of intrigued. What is this show that's popping to the top of the rankings? And then I decided to watch it and found it very compelling because I felt like it hit upon a lot of themes that are going on today. And also in other works that have been prominent coming from South Korea, such as the movie Parasite that won an Oscar,
right,
where they talk, basically it's about capitalism and the extreme negative side of what can happen when there's too much of a disparity between the poor and the rich and the exploitation that can happen. So Korea has been particularly nailing those issues in their recent artworks.
Well, talk more about that. Your essay is called What Squid Game Is Really About, How Decades of Korean Trauma Have Spawned a Pop Culture Phenomenon. What is that trauma that lies behind modern Korean culture?
Korea's just had a very difficult 20th century. They were basically occupied by Imperial Japan for the first half of the century, and then were freed after the Japanese lost World War II. In the meantime, the country got divided in half by the Soviets and the United States, and the Korean War happened in the 50s, which was definitely the most chaotic event they went through in modern history. And since then, the country has been split and following two very different paths, the North and the South.
Your parents emigrated from South Korea to the U.S. in 1971. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Korea right now, something you might be living through, were you there? You do talk about economic pressure and the widening gap between rich and poor in South Korea, but that's also kind of like the U.S. Does that help explain Squid Game's popularity here?
It's a global phenomenon where the economic disparity is happening in pretty much every country on the planet now, to varying degrees. Definitely, it's been a major theme of politics and concerns here. What I guess Korea's kind of bringing to the table is that it's kind of difficult to escape your neighbor there in a way. It's a very small country and kind of one big crazy family, as I put it. And they literally live on top of each other. It's mainly high-rise buildings that everyone lives in. So there's no way to really avoid seeing people you know who are super rich now versus super poor. And I think that breeds some resentment and tension that's inspiring some of these works coming out, because it's just unavoidable to feel that human discord that comes from that.
Jean, I'm really curious what you make of South Korea seemingly dominating culture across the globe right now. I mean, there's a lot going on.
It's kind of amazing to me because growing up in America, you just didn't hear much about Korea. Everyone always used to ask me, are you Chinese or Japanese? Korea wasn't really on the map at all. So to see it become this thing that everyone knows now, that just random people I talk to know, random actors who are in Korea that I wouldn't think they would know, it's kind of exciting for me, but it's very interesting.
So in your own space, Jean Kim, you've earned an MD, a master's degree in writing. You're teaching at a major university, and you blog. Your byline is in a lot of major publications. I mean, you're a success. So if you were a player in Squid Game, how would you do?
I wouldn't really want to join the game, hopefully. I'm hoping that, yeah, that I can find what's happy in life and not need tons of money to feel happy with my life. And maybe that's part of what the show is about, that what else can we do to make human beings feel fulfilled outside of this system?
Psychiatrist Jean Kim teaches at George Washington University, speaking with us about the Korean cultural underpinnings of the blockbuster Netflix series Squid Game. Jean, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's mushroom hunting season in Spain. People are excited to get back to the forest after last year's strict quarantine measures. In Spain's northeast region of Catalonia, mushroom hunting has been part of small-town culture for generations. But the increasing number of city people coming to hunt is starting to take a toll on the residents in mushroom country. The world's Lucia Benavides at the center of Catalonia has our story.
Every autumn, Barcelona explodes with mushrooms. Not in the literal sense, they've yet to grow out of concrete slabs. But they're everywhere you look, at neighborhood food markets, restaurant lunch specials, even on books in window displays. So after 5 years of living here, I decided it was time to go mushroom hunting for the very first time. But I needed someone who knows about local mushrooms to guide me. My partner Alan and I met up with Pep González, a 49-year-old road maintenance worker who has been hunting for mushrooms since he was a child, a love passed down by his grandmother. We met in a small town about an hour and a half north of Barcelona, close to the Pyrenees Mountains. People like him, who know every little detail about where and when to find the right mushrooms, are called buletaires, a term that comes from the Catalan word for mushrooms, bulets. We head into the forest with two baskets in hand and our dog Luna sniffing the ground, as if searching for mushrooms as well. We don't follow a trail. González says the best mushrooms are out of sight. But right away, González reprimands us for speaking too loudly.
Tienes que aprender a escuchar el silencio.
You need to learn to listen to the silence around us, he says as he points to the trees. González says hunting for mushrooms is about more than just finding them. It's also about being in nature and paying attention. We continue in silence, hearing the crunch of leaves beneath our feet and smelling the wafts of rosemary and thyme set off by our touch. Soon, González finds the first mushroom of the day.
Hola, estoy flipando. Una brumosa.
It's a brumosa, a small grayish-white mushroom with a stereotypically rounded top and slimy stem. Apparently, we're in luck. These can be hard to come by. Especially on a dry day like today, the area hasn't gotten rain in over a week.
Sí, mira, ves otra. Otra cama de perdido.
Throughout the two-hour hike, we come across dozens of mushrooms that are inedible. Some are poisonous, others are dried up or rotten. It's not a particularly bountiful day, but we do find around 20 mushrooms to take home, and of various types.
Cada bolet tiene su especificación para cocinar.
González says that each mushroom, or bullet, has its own specific use for cooking. Yellowfoot for Spanish tortillas, penny buns for carpaccio, and waxy caps for grilling. As we head back to town, González tells me this area is full of tourists on weekends. That's led some people, especially farmers, to pressure local governments to charge for mushroom hunting and regulate the activity.
Es una finca privada.
A majority of forests in Catalonia are privately owned, he says, even the one we visited today. But locals have been hiking these woods for decades, with little to no complaint from farmers. It's only in the past 10 years or so, González says, that it's become a problem. Mushroom hunting has gone mainstream, so to speak, and city people are coming in droves, often leaving trash behind or damaging the natural habitat. But González says he's not sure regulation is the answer.
Yo lo veo bien por una parte.
On the one hand, he thinks a forest should be taken care of, and paying a maintenance fee may work. But on the other hand, he says, the forest should belong to everybody, not just to those who can afford to come. After the hike, we head to a family-run restaurant for lunch. Just as we're digging into our starter, a creamy mushroom soup, a 75-year-old man walks in with two full bags of freshly picked mushrooms. He's here to sell them to the restaurant owners. Today, he brought in 4 kilos, about 8 pounds, of bullets, he says in Catalan. But some days, he finds up to 10 kilos worth. He always comes here to sell. He's from the area and knows the owners. He says he charges per kilo, but won't say how much. Like Gonzalez, he goes mushroom hunting several times a week this time of year, and usually alone.
No.
He and Gonzalez agree that true buletairas never share the best spots they've found. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
Nigeria is the most populous country in Africa. More than 200 million people live there. Increasingly, violence and fear are tearing Nigeria apart in ways not seen since Nigeria's civil war in the late 1960s. According to UNICEF, there have been 20 attacks on schools this year and 1,500 abductions. Earlier this week, a criminal gang killed 43 people at a village market. The chaos in Nigeria is discussed in a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist. Jason Palmer is its host. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
We've been hearing about kidnapping in Nigeria for years, going back to the first girls abducted from Chibok. Hashtag bring back our girls went viral globally, and things are now getting worse. Is kidnapping the biggest problem?
Well, it's certainly a huge problem, a high visibility one, as you say. I spoke to Kinley Salmon, an Africa correspondent here at The Economist, and he told us that it's now common for there to be security checks when visiting schools and universities in Nigeria, but on a recent visit to a school in the southwest, police stopped the taxi he was in on the way out just to check for abducted students. But kidnapping is just one of the things making Nigerians fearful, and some of the biggest problems, Kinley told me, vary by the region.
Well, in the northeast, there's been this insurgency, you know, mostly associated with Boko Haram since 2009. And for a long time, that was the dominant jihadist force in northeast Nigeria. But today, a splinter group, Islamic State West Africa Province, actually outguns it. And then in the northwest of Nigeria, criminal gangs that locals call bandits are sweeping into villages, often on motorbikes. There they threaten to burn down houses or block farmers' access to their fields, demanding payment. And these bandits are responsible for many of the kidnappings of students, too. And in fact, they've killed more people in the northwest of Nigeria this year than have died in the northeast at the hands of the jihadists.
That's just the north of the country. In the southeast, there are separatists trying to revive the breakaway state of Biafra. That was the state that was at the center of that civil war, one that killed about a million Nigerians. Last year, what's now an organization called the Indigenous People of Biafra launched an armed wing that's been carrying out attacks on election offices, police stations, a prison. That, in turn, has driven a pretty lethal crackdown by security forces. All told, Kinley says the whole country is sliding towards ungovernability.
Why have things gotten so bad in Nigeria?
Well, at root, Kinley says it's poor governance, and that partly has colonial roots. Britain lumped together many different ethnic groups in one country, Muslims in the north, Christians in the south. But there's also the instability brought about by the country's oil industry, the sort of political grabs for the cash from that, that draws attention away from everyday Nigerians' needs and worries. This is a kind of feedback loop. All that anger and fear and lawlessness, Kinley says, can drive otherwise peaceable people to violence.
And then we also see, you know, clashes between herders and farmers across much of the center of the country. They're both competing to use the same land. And that itself has killed thousands of people, but it's also fueled other crises. Some herders have turned to kidnapping, and then separatists in the southeast, for example, talk up the dangers from these herdsmen to justify them taking up arms. And so the sort of vicious circle continues.
So many divisions in Nigeria. What's the government doing about all this, Jason?
Well, it varies in what part of the country we're talking about. In the northeast, where the problem is jihadist groups, the government's given up on trying to defeat them and is instead just trying to contain them. In the northwest, the army does try to fight back against those bandits, but there and throughout the country, really, the security services are notoriously heavy-handed, and so it perpetuates that vicious circle. By this point, they're thinly stretched. The army's deployed now in every one of Nigeria's 36 states.
What about the general population in Nigeria? I mean, as you said earlier, Jason, a lot of people living in fear, they could be the next victims.
Yeah, the visceral fear of kidnapping, that general sense that violence is so widespread, is making people feel that it's harder and harder to live and work in Nigeria. At the same time, the violence has spooked international investors. That's a knock on the economy, but at the same time, the population is growing faster than the economy is. So as all of this is going on, Nigerians are just getting poorer. And Kinley says some are just ready to give up on the country.
Opinion polls show that nearly half of adults want to leave Nigeria, and among the young, a clear majority wish to live somewhere else. Foreign investors like Shell, which has long been Nigeria's biggest foreign investor, recently said that it would pull out, and also cited the threat of violence. And all this is in a way particularly sad, because there are parts of Nigeria that are still thriving. Lagos, the commercial capital, has plenty of troubles, but is so dynamic that it boasts a large tech scene, and also in Nigeria's answer to Hollywood, what they term Nollywood, a bustling film industry.
Wow, stunning that half of Nigerians want to leave the country. But Kinley does add there a bit of optimism to the overall picture.
A bit. The better off in Nigeria, and the politicians do have a stake in preserving and improving the system. And as Kinley says, Nigerians do have plenty of national pride. But for now, the bonds between the state and its people are just really shaky.
Jason Palmer, host of The Intelligence. You can hear more of his conversation with Kinley Salmon about the situation in Nigeria on The Intelligence podcast from our partners at The Economist. Jason, thanks as always for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Marco.
Nations around the globe continue to roll out their COVID-19 vaccination campaigns, but what about people who live in conflict zones? On Monday, the world's Alana Gordon will moderate a discussion with a panel of experts about the challenges of getting vaccines to millions of people living amid violence and political instability. It's part of our series of conversations on the pandemic with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Join us on Monday at noon Eastern at theworld.org, and send your questions to myworld@theworld.org. Since the fraudulent election in Belarus in August of 2020, the country has been on edge. That is the view from the balcony. Move closer in and there's another story afoot. Belarus has been inviting Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans to apply for tourist visas for a few months now. Then the government in Minsk sends these people to its borders with neighboring Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland. The scheme has been labeled the weaponizing of migrants. Franek Viachorka has been following this tactic and all the latest out of Minsk. He's a former journalist from Belarus and joins us now from Vilnius, Lithuania, where he works as senior advisor to Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Franek, the so-called weaponizing of migrants, how does this scheme actually work?
Every day, a number of flights are coming from Middle East, from countries like Lebanon, Iraq, to Minsk. These flights are bringing hundreds of people who are looking for the better life in the European Union. They spent 3-4 days in Minsk. Then military cars of Belarusian army are bringing them to the border with Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland. And they are left there. Border control and secret services of Belarus are telling them, you can go to the EU there. And many of them has to cross the river or cross the forest to get to the EU. But EU doesn't want to let them in, so they're pushed back. But when they are trying to get back to Belarus, Belarusian border control with guns in hand, with Kalashnikovs and with dogs, they stop them there too. And they are basically, hundreds of people are stuck on the neutral zone. Many of these people are suffering. Many are getting injured, and some people are dying.
Why is the Lukashenko government going to such lengths to aggravate its EU neighbors, using humans as pawns?
For him, Afghani, Iraqi, Syrians, Lebanese, they don't have like any value to him. He doesn't care about these personal stories, about their lives, about their aspirations, about their hopes. He doesn't care about people's lives. We saw it during the COVID crisis when Lukashenko said you can treat COVID with vodka, with tractor. Even today, he said that it should not be mandatory to wear masks. And he canceled all the regulations requiring vaccination for employees of public service.
Also this week, Belarusian authorities raided the offices of Novy Chas, one of the few remaining opposition media outlets in Minsk. What did your contacts in Belarus tell you about the raid?
So Novy Chas is one of very few media outlets that remain in Belarus. Most of these organizations got liquidated, got closed. Just you go to your office, you open your computer, and suddenly KGB, it's still called KGB in Belarus, is coming to your apartment, raiding your office, confiscating your computer, and arrest all the people in the room. They interrogate you for 8 or 16 hours. And if they see that you're criticizing Lukashenko, if they see there is a sticker, oppositional sticker on your computer, they can detain you for 3 more days, then for 3 months, and then for years. And most of the people who are detained right now, including journalists, did not commit any crimes. They just got detained, and only in KGB they found the charge against these people.
And is that in fact what happened this week?
It's what's happening every day. Half of my Facebook news feed is already detained, is in prison. I didn't hear from so many friends and relatives I have in Belarus because they got detained. I know that some of them are in jail in Minsk, some of them in Gomel, but most of them, we don't know even location.
So going back to the 2020 presidential election, thousands of people were jailed during the massive protests across Belarus. Those protests began in the lead up to that vote, a vote most people considered as rigged. We heard reports that people had been tortured by police. Some people died. How many people are still believed to be behind bars?
41,000 got detained, but most of them already released. About 3,000 are still behind bars under criminal charges. Some of them are facing a death penalty, 15 years, 25 years in prison. 800 of them are recognized political prisoners. And this is the atmosphere people live in. So it's very difficult to expect any street protest in such atmosphere. But at the same time, it's hard to believe this system can sustain for a long time.
So as I said, Franek, you are in Lithuania working directly with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the opposition presidential candidate who was defeated, according to Alexander Lukashenko, by him. How does she further her political goals from exile?
She's advocating for Belarus internationally. She has met Joe Biden, Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, Boris Johnson. And I was with her at most of these meetings. And she is like the symbol of new Belarus. She's greeted like a state leader. But on the other hand, she's a symbol and inspiration for many Belarusians inside the country. Every day from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., she's on the calls with workers, students, doctors who are sharing their concerns with her, who are saying that, oh, you know, our friends got detained. Can you help us? And she's trying to be the leader, but also the friend to many of these people who are still on that side of the border and continue the resistance movement. And at the same time, she has her husband in as the hostage in Belarus prison. It's very difficult, but somehow she manages.
Franek Viachorka is a former journalist and now senior advisor to Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. He's been speaking with us from Vilnius. Franek, thank you very much for answering our questions.
Thank you.
Ending the show today with something new and something old. Not that old, something that I missed last summer. In July, 7 guys went to the forests of Peru with their instruments and began a jam in honor of Peru's bicentennial, July 28th. This is Barreto, the Peruvian band formed in the early 2000s, covering vintage psychedelic cumbia from the 60s and 70s, and writing their own songs. From their first album in 2005, Barreto's sound has remained consistent. Psychedelic cumbia, nods to jazz, and even heavier nods to Jamaica. Which brings us to the title track from Barreto's newest release, Cumbia Circular, a really slow cumbia number that magically morphs into reggae, featuring guest vocalist Maria del Rosario. If that doesn't make life more chill as you head into the weekend, I'm not sure how else to help. By the way, there's cool video of the band doing that bicentennial forest jam. Well worth checking out. We've got that on our Twitter. We are at the world. Dance, la, la, la, cool. And that's going to do it for us. New music from Peru's Barreto plays us out. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We're back with you here on Monday. Viva.